Welcome back to another episode of Winning Through Culture. I am Tim Flanagan. I'm here today, excited to be with Dan Roselli. Dan is co-founder of RevTech Labs and Packard Place in Uptown Charlotte. So welcome, Dan.
Yeah, good to be here, Tim. Thanks for the invite.
Great to have you here. So a little bit more about Dan, but I think on the interesting introduction side is that he knows more about M&Ms and tequila than any human being you've ever met. We may or may not get into that today. He has a rare blend of Fortune 500 experience and successful entrepreneurial track record. He's got a background in Fortune 500 marketing experiences with General Mills, Colgate, M&Ms, and Bank of America. You were the youngest member in history of Bank of America on their operating committee.
Yeah.
And you have co-founded three separate companies that made it to the Inc. 500 magazine list of fastest growing private companies in America. And as I introduced you, you've now co-founded one of the largest and most successful entrepreneurial and tech hubs in the world right here in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Apparently I can't keep a job.
Well, I don't know if you can't keep a job or you just keep progressing in your vision of what you want to accomplish, because I know something that's really important to you is social entrepreneurship, conscious capitalism, and the power of the free market to change the world, which I love all those things as well. So perhaps it's just an evolution towards that.
I like that. I'll take your version.
All right. I like that too. And I've loved to watch over the years what you've done with RevTech Labs and Packard Place and all the, I think you said you have 19 cohorts of companies now that have come through.
Yeah, cohort 19 is active right now.
So all those ideas and entrepreneurs that got launched and given a chance of life to take their idea into the marketplace and succeed, you've done a great job in the community and beyond, quite frankly. So thank you for that. And thank you for the work you do. You've got your 7 Habits of Highly Effective Persons workshop coming up, I guess, in January.
I do it every January.
Yeah, January. That's what I remember.
The community, yeah.
Yep. I used to be a facilitator of that. And every time I see that, I'm like, oh, I miss those. They were a long 3 days if you do it all 3 days.
Yeah, we do half days.
Okay.
12 hours.
Takes a little energy out of you. Yeah. But I used to love doing that. So that's an awesome contribution you make to the community. So today, Dan, we're here to talk about cultures of innovation. And I think you are eminently qualified on this topic with your background and experience. But maybe as a starting point, kind of setting the table, how would you define a culture of innovation in a company or workplace today?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is culture and environment, right? You have to create an environment where people can take risks and fail and be rewarded for failing. And that is so counterintuitive to American businesses, right?
Yeah.
It's common in entrepreneurship.
Avoid failure at all costs.
Corporations, yeah, right.
Yeah.
That we're paid to not fail, right? To hit singles. And I think corporations struggle with that a lot because they're just not used to rewarding failure. Go take a big swing and maybe it'll work out, maybe it won't, but it won't hurt. A good example of that, I've often championed our corporate partners to think about doing an entrepreneurial sabbatical program. Right, where someone could leave for a year, kind of like an expat assignment.
Wow.
Go take a shot at this idea that they have and guarantee them a job back in a year if it doesn't work out. Not the same job, just like an expat, an equivalent job. And all of a sudden, you've dramatically lowered the risk of leaving a corporate job to go take a swing at entrepreneurship. And I still haven't gotten any corporate partners to bite on that. Because then it gets into logistics and HR and policies. Are they employees? Are they not? Do they get vested? Do they not?
All the complications,
the reality. But, you know,
so. It's a great idea, though.
I think it's
so. So would the company then, in that idea, Dan, pay that employee to start the business?
No. So not even
just
pay.
Just give them the safety net. If it doesn't work out,
absolutely,
you have a home to come back to.
Which, in theory, bright people could do that on their own. And take a swing at entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
But then, if it doesn't work out, just go find a job.
Something else.
But it just creates a mental security. And it's also, more importantly, Tim, I think it's a statement by the company.
Yes.
Right. That we want to foster innovation and rather than lose our best talent, you know, if you really take that to the next step, give them a small stake. Maybe you do keep them on a low level payroll or keep them on benefit.
Yeah.
Right.
Something keeps them tied.
And then you can take a stake in the company, right? It'd be a great way to foster innovation. And importantly, well, I'm sure we'll talk more about this, get them outside the culture of the big company, right? Big companies are just not built for innovation that way.
Now, it's a great idea, though. I mean, even for a smaller company. If you have the ability to let a person in the organization go on that entrepreneurial sabbatical for a year, gives you a chance to try some new things too. That's cool. So as the ever-evolving, rapidly changing world around us, what do you think the importance of continuously adapting and evolving in the approach to innovation is in business today?
Yeah, you know, my favorite business quote or even entrepreneurial quote actually comes from a scientist, not from a business person, Charles Darwin.
Ah.
The species that survive are not necessarily the strongest or the fastest. They're the most responsive to change, right? Yeah. And so what big companies generally have going for them is they're big, they have great resources, but they're not all that responsive to change. And so I think you kind of have to do that constant process of creative destruction where you're changing how you're doing it and never happy with the status quo. You kind of constantly have to be asking yourself, what's next on how we do this? And being the ones that reinvent yourself versus having the marketplace drive you out and having to do it the hard way.
Yeah, I heard a CEO once say that he wanted to disrupt his company and industry before someone else did.
Yeah, we want to cannibalize our own revenue versus have someone else cannibalize it for us.
Do it for us. Well, and you know, again, that you said failing is a counterintuitive approach. So is, I think, that idea for a lot of businesses. I mean, what are some of the practical steps, I guess, an organization can take to kind of go down that path of, in essence, cannibalizing their own
business model? I think it starts from the leadership, whether it's big company or small company, Fortune 500 or startup, those cues get taken from the leaders, right? And you have to create an environment where you're challenging people. And it's enlightened self-interest. You should want to get 100% of people's innovation capacity, whether you have 40,000 employees or you have 4 employees.
Yeah.
And that comes from the leadership and creating an environment where that's true and just reiterating that constantly and rewarding people who take risks regardless of whether they pan out or not. One of the things I'll tell you to avoid, which I love big corporations, we have a lot of great partners, but every time this happens, and it still happens, I just kind of chuckle, someone will spend $3 million on room infrastructure and furniture and create an innovation lab because big corporations can point to a physical space and
there it is.
Look at the bright colors and the no walls and the
how cool it is.
$1,000 whiteboard we put up, right? And none of that has anything to do with innovation. But universities to big companies, I see it happen all the time. This will create a space so we can point to it and take photos of it and look how innovative we are. And it's the last thing you need is innovative physical space. On the checklist of 20 things you need, it is dead last.
I could see that. So what are the top 3 things on that checklist of
innovative? Yeah, I think leadership is, right? Yep. I was fortunate enough to work for Bank of America for a while. You mentioned that, and I'll never forget. I had someone come up to me after a presentation I made at the American Bankers Association. It's like, well, how do you convince your leadership to go be innovative and take risks and all the things I talked about? And I said, you know, you go work someplace where the CEO already believes that.
Yeah.
And he looked very disillusioned and disappointed in that answer.
Yeah.
You're not going to change your CEO, right? If you're an employee, small company or big company, you have to seek out. And that's why we tell people, seek out environments where they're sending those signals, even connecting the dots back to that entrepreneurial sabbatical idea. 99.9% of the employees at a big company are never going to take advantage of that. But it's a signal of what the company's philosophy is and the leader's philosophy is about, you know, trying to foster innovation and wanting innovative people to come there. It's a lighthouse that attracts innovative people.
So I'm a leader and I'm like, all right, I want to be the leader that you just described that people say is innovative as opposed to unwilling to adapt and change. I mean, the sabbatical idea is an amazing idea. What are some of the other things as a leader I need to be considering doing to really, as the leader, model the behavior of fostering an innovative culture?
Yeah. The number one recommendation I have is ask the team.
Okay.
You have a brain trust of people. You have a bigger brain trust than most people do. Sometimes it's 2 or 3 people, sometimes it'd be thousands. They're going to come up with great ideas. Mm-hmm. If you threw that challenge exactly as you described it to me out to the team, and be prepared to be uncomfortable with the responses, right? If you're not uncomfortable as the leader, it probably means you're not being open enough to being pushed on it.
Yeah.
And so the hard part, I remember a time when I was at General Mills, a young, ambitious 23-year-old, and one of the senior executives came to us and tried to give us the rah-rah speech on innovation. And I was naive enough, I raised my hand. It's like, you understand that nothing you do in your compensation system actually backs up what you just said you want.
That's 23-year-old Dan.
he looked very hurt. I've never been afraid to kind of call it like it is.
Yeah.
And it's true for leaders. The larger our leadership opportunity is, the more we have to lose
Yeah.
And therefore, the less willing we are to take risks.
Yeah. And I think that's true. And I think the idea that, as you mentioned earlier, kind of rewarding failure, again, counterintuitive. You know, I think it was Charles Schwab that once had an employee make a very expensive mistake. This was years and years ago. And a person offered their resignation. And he said, I just spent $1 million educating you. You're going to stay right here where you are. I'm not accepting your resignation.
Right.
I may not have all my facts straight there, but I think the idea that allowing people to try things that might not work is another trait of a leader that fosters innovation. And then I think the transparency of what it is that you yourself as a leader are ultimately willing to try to adapt and be different.
Yeah, I think most leaders, and you kind of said this even in your comment, feel the burden is on them to create this. It's not.
Yeah.
Your burden is to unleash potential people.
And people. Yeah. We've talked about a few of these, but are there other barriers or challenges organizations face in trying to create a culture of innovation?
Yeah, certainly public companies face the profit pressure. Right?
Yeah.
Everything is such short term. How is it going to deliver revenue or profitability now?
Now.
And that's just not how innovation works, mm-hmm. right? So I think private companies, whether they're billion-dollar private companies or startups, have an advantage there. I've also found a lot, especially in our work, a lot of public companies love working with accelerators and in the ecosystem we play because they can monitor that, help guide it, and to sometimes be advisors for it without having to own it and control it, right? So I think for big corporations, sometimes the sense that we need to be innovative within our walls is where people get locked in the blinders way too fast versus the how do we assess, engage, and be aware of the innovation that's happening in the world. You don't need to control the innovation to be able to capitalize on it, right? And I think corporations are learning that more and more.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I remember going to one of your live fintech sessions pre-COVID, and I went, somebody said, what are you going to that for? And I said, I want to see what's coming down the pike in the financial services space around the intersection of technology and finance. And that was it was a great couple of days. I mean, you guys had some great speakers and some really interesting things. So again, trying to get out ahead of where you are and see what's coming is probably another
big thing. We actually describe our work sometimes as an early warning radar system, right? The very farthest out in terms of people who are starting companies. Where's the heat map of where people are starting companies and in what space?
Yep. I think a lot of people automatically equate technology with innovation, but that is not necessarily the case.
Right.
I mean, where are places you're seeing innovation now in the organizations you guys are supporting?
Yeah. So we deal with a lot of early stage companies, primarily Series A. And lots of times it's taking existing technology and just implementing. We have a lot of founders who will get up and say, this industry has operated the exact same way for the last 30 years.
Yep.
And even though the technology to change has been out there for 10 years, no one has done that. Very rarely are the founders creating truly new technologies. They're creating new ways of implementing that.
Interesting.
And creating in a way that is usable and functional. It's just really hard for battleships, big corporations to move, right?
Yep.
And so if you can get someone that can build a platform that uses existing technology but makes the process more efficient, makes the end user experience that much better, and then they can go acquire them for $50 million versus try and build it on their own, that's a path that most companies like at this point.
Well, and I would think the one thing that is probably prevalent in innovation today is the user experience, the client experience. I mean, talk a little bit about that, if you would, for a minute, Dan, because it was a great point you made. The integration of technology into our lives is pretty prevalent. It's how do you utilize some of these tools in a way that haven't been utilized before?
Yeah. So a couple examples. One of my best recommendations for folks is to, especially when it comes to user experience and innovation, is get outside your industry, right? Customers do not live, or clients don't live, in a silo that is only your industry. They're exposed to everything from travel to restaurants to Amazon. And their expectations about how the experience is going to be is driven by the very best in class across industries.
Yeah.
And that's part of the problem that financial services, I think in particular, and insurance as well, has lagged behind is the user experience in lots of categories have gone so far ahead. And the younger the consumer, the more the expectation, that this ought to work this way, regardless of what industry I'm interacting with. So that's number one, get outside your industry. I think the other one that's interesting is there's a lot of technology that has been used for a long time. I'm going to talk about AI and machine learning, right? The buzzwords. Yeah. Before it was blockchain or crypto, right?
Oh, yeah. The buzzwords changed. All the buzzwords changed.
And it's funny, we had a lot of entrepreneurs pitch 5 years ago that we're a blockchain company.
I remember that.
And there is no such thing as a blockchain company. Blockchain is a technology.
The technology, not a company.
You to do something of value, right? Yeah. But blockchain could be an underlying technology, but you're not a blockchain company. You're a payments company or you're a lending company utilizing blockchain to do the same thing. AI is the same way. There's no such thing as an AI company. There's companies that use AI in order to create value, again, through one of those avenues. And it's also interesting that everyone, and I don't think we want to go down this rabbit hole in this podcast, Tim, but the folks who talk and been using machine learning and deep language learning for a long time are all of a sudden now AI companies. And people put AI on a whole bunch of stuff that's not actually AI.
Yeah.
I know that's a shocker for your listeners.
Yeah, well, it's, yeah. We won't go down that rabbit hole, yeah. But I mean, I think the machine learning, again, is a good example of a technology that's been around a fairly long time that is finding new applications. So as you think about if I'm a large or small company and I'm like, all right, we need to be more innovative, you know, where do you start?
Yeah. I think part of it is creating the right culture, right? So start with leadership.
So leadership first.
Yeah, it creates the culture of walking the walk, of allowing people to take risks and celebrating that, not penalizing that, even when it doesn't work out. The third thing that I find people do wrong, big and small companies, is we're so focused on efficiency.
Okay.
Efficiency is inversely correlated with innovation, in my opinion.
Got it.
The idea of let's get outside your industry. And you talked about this earlier, coming to one of our events. So you're a good person to the role model saying, hey, I'm doing something out of my
normal peer group,
right? None of my peers are going to be at this session, but I'm doing it because it changes the way I think. It allows me to see what's coming. And the whole idea of looking at outside your industry, well, none of that's efficient. It's great for innovation, but none of it's efficient. So I think you have to create physical mechanisms that allow people the time and the mental freedom to go look at that. That's where ideas come from. They don't come from doing the 10th version of the same widget.
Sitting in a meeting.
Right?
Talking about it, iterative efficiencies of whatever. Okay. So leadership, setting the tone, creating a culture that embraces change and failure, because that's a part of it. And then ultimately getting outside your bubble, your world day to day, and looking at things through a different lens, through different experiences. And I do think you hit on something that's really important. I've personally done this is, you know, go look at the user experience from all the other encounters you have in your day-to-day life and what can you learn or take from those? Because that's, again, somebody's already innovated and done something different, perhaps to an entirely different industry than yours, but what can you take from that and apply to your own business?
Yeah. One more comment I'll make on that, which is find out kind of what your mental ruts are, right? If you happen to be a 50-year-old white male, find a 25-year-old who can mentor you on what 25-year-olds are thinking, right?
Yep.
If you happen to have lived in terms of a neighborhood that's not very demographically diverse, challenge yourself to go out and find diversity when you do. I mean, there are, outside of the political whatevers, there is great value in innovation and diversity.
Oh, yeah. They go together.
Yeah. And so you get 10 people, the same life experience as a room, they're not nearly going to come up with the same level of innovation. A really diverse group of people with a diverse life set and perspective will come up with.
Well, I think that's a great point specific to innovation is if you're going to, as a company, innovate, don't have people that think, act, and see the world through the same lens all together coming up with new ideas that may have very similar patterns to those ideas, try and get a very wide diversity of background.
It sounds obvious that you're saying it, but you'd be amazed.
No, trust me. You know, I think it was Albert Einstein that says, you know, you can't solve a problem from the same perspective at which you created it.
Yeah.
And I think that's the same notion that if you're innovating, you need to do it with a diversity of thought, experiences, backgrounds, and life stories.
Yeah.
You're going to get a better tapestry than if you just get five people in a room that all see things the same way.
Yeah.
So I think that mental rut is a good visual. When you think about the business today, and again, obviously larger corporations, it's an even bigger issue, but just kind of the ethical considerations for both innovation and or the use of artificial intelligence back to machine learning. You know, what are some of the things you guys are seeing in the work you're doing right now?
Yeah, the biggest ethical implication in my viewpoint is, whether you call it machine learning, deep language learning, AI, that system is still being taught by something.
Correct.
It doesn't spontaneously generate.
Didn't come out of nowhere.
And so if you input biased data and data sets, you will end up with biased outputs to it, right? So how you train machine learning and AI is critically important. And, you know, I'll say another shocker. As humans, we are all inherently flawed in some way. Right?
And biased, yes. Right.
So I don't think we've solved the challenge of how do you truly create an unbiased algorithm or system. And there's lots of times where we see this in lending, right? Somebody will create a black box algorithm that doesn't include any of the biased characteristics you're not allowed and shouldn't be asking, and yet the outputs are still all racially biased.
But, interesting.
Well, how did that happen?
Yeah.
And so we also have to understand the intent for those types of tools versus the impact. And I think we always have to be looking and validating the impact at the end, saying, is this really doing what we wanted to do? Because there are some times, I'll pick on Tesla because I'm a Tesla owner.
Okay.
Look at the AI machine learning that's in the self-driving program, and there is no way I would close my eyes and let the car drive. No way that's going to happen, right? Because it's perfect. 99.5% of the time. That other
point, that 0.5 could go bad.
There's literally a point where it could almost kill me every day if I wasn't paying attention.
Yeah. Yeah. No. I think that's, you know, on the ethical side, it is an important distinction to make that as innovative technologies evolve, if they're basically programmed with a bias, they're going to have a biased output. And humans, to your point, are inherently flawed beings with biases. So don't expect that technology to innovate in a way that's going to solve for that.
It's also interesting, just go back to Tesla for a quick second. I'll get the stat wrong, Tim, but unfortunately, I think something like 35 or 40,000 Americans die every year in automobile accidents, right? As safe as we make cars, and that's gone down dramatically
time, from right? What it was.
Seatbelts and crumple zones and all that. If we switch to AI-driven cars tomorrow and cut that number in half and only 20,000 people died, Americans still wouldn't stand for it, because now it's a machine and AI, quote unquote, killing 20,000 people, even though they've cut the number in half. So there's a psychological thing for us that we just feel differently when it's the machine making a choice versus the human. Even if that human is flawed, and even if they make a mistake in it, we haven't gotten to the point where we're letting to a machine be twice as right as humans and still being okay with that outcome.
Well, a little more compassion maybe for people over machines.
Right. Exactly.
In spite of the statistics, yeah. As you think about companies that you've worked with, both big and small, again, through the cohorts that you've done with the startups, what's the secret of sustaining innovative culture long-term?
You know, in entrepreneurship, the most common formula we see is not 22-year-olds in flip-flops and cut-off jean shorts, right? In financial services and insurance, it's people who've had careers. And the formula is, I went and did this for 20 years. And saw this pain point, and over two decades, no one has still solved it. So I went and created the company that I, as an industry expert, always wanted to see, saw the need for, and no one did. And I think that formula is fantastic, right?
Okay.
Because you almost have the early stages of product market fit, because at least they experienced that pain point as an industry expert. And so a lot of our founders have that formula at heart. And most of our founders are late 30s, 40s, 50s, because they need that life experience, and they need to have experienced where innovation hasn't happened and where it hasn't been brought, and that's why they bring it. I think that's interesting. The analogy we use a lot in entrepreneurship is, are you selling a pain pill or a vitamin?
Mm.
We all know vitamins are good for us, but most of us don't take them every day. But if we have a raging headache, we're going to go get the aspirin.
Yeah.
Right? And so we try and figure out, where's our true pain point that innovation hasn't solved yet? And I think entrepreneurs are particularly well-suited to go do that because they're willing to take the risks.
Mm-hmm.
One last comment I'll make on that. On day one of our program, I show all of our founders the Steve Jobs video, the Think Different video, if you remember that from 15 years ago, and all these world-class change agents and thinkers. And what I tell the class is, if you're sitting in one of these chairs in RevTech Labs and you've been selected as one of the 15 founding companies out of 450 applicants, you are not a normal human being. You are not in the standard deviation of humanity, right? You're just not in terms of risk tolerance, innovation. And I think finding those folks, and I think whether you're a big company or not too, finding those folks who are not normal human beings and are outside that standard deviation, I think drive disproportionately innovation.
Well, and I think that's a good point too, kind of getting back to culture of a company. Are you embracing sameness or are you embracing, again, a diversity of, because I would imagine from my own experience, and certainly I'd love to hear yours, Dan, but some of the people might have some personality quirks that fit in, so to speak, in a quote unquote normal culture.
And that's why I said, as leaders, if you're trying to foster it, you have to be ready to be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because if you're not in that mindset, those potential people on your team, they are going to make you uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Another great reference that a lot of people probably know, the book about Lincoln's cabinet, Team of Rivals.
Yeah, Team of Rivals. Right? Yeah.
Where they talk about, again, different life perspectives. But if you can find and get that team rowing in the same direction by alignment with mission, by alignment with, you know, what we're trying to do for customers, that really diverse team can be really impactful. But it takes more work and it takes more effort. And not all leaders can do that. But the leaders that can unleash that with a very diverse team that make each other uncomfortable, find a way to work.
So the long-term success of an innovative organization is the leaders continually keeping the team diversified enough, in essence, with how they approach things to continually find new opportunities. And I think you said something also that is important to note, which is a lot of innovation comes from solving long-standing problems. It's not this completely new, groundbreaking idea. They come along too, but they're probably very rare compared to somebody identifying an issue that hasn't been solved for before and coming up with a solution.
Right. It's incremental steps forward. And I'll go back to my own personal experience at B of A, again, being brash at 31, 32 when I joined Bank of America. I'm sure they had people that had three times experience. Somebody was 52 interviewing for that job. And I remember saying, if you want someone to maintain the status quo, don't hire me.
Right?
Because I'll be miserable. I'll make you miserable. I'll leave. Which is a pretty bold thing to say when you're interviewing for a job.
When you're 31 years old and you're kind of...
But you're going to lose, right?
Yeah.
And I think you're looking for people who are willing to be those internal change agents. But I also, right, you also are disruptive internally to the organization. It doesn't make it smooth sailing. It makes it more productive sailing.
Yeah, and I think that person runs the risk, again, depending on the organization, of basically being run out as a virus from the system.
I give you many analogies that are probably inappropriate for the podcast.
I'll save that later. But yes, the status quo wants to push out the innovator.
Yes, the corporate antibodies
fight back. They fight back. Yes, I can speak to that myself. So let's switch gears, though, to a more inspiring story of either an individual team or an organization, you know, who have made a significant impact through their innovative efforts. I mean, I'm sure you have several stories, but anyone come to mind?
Yeah, there's a bunch, especially in the financial services space, right? I mean, look at what Plaid has done on democratizing access to consumers' information. If listeners don't know, Plaid basically allows startups to get access to bank information through a common interface versus trying to have to go work with all the banks. Even look at what SoFi did, right, in the lending space, and all the way back to Elon Musk things at PayPal, right, which was really the first major kind of digital payments platform. Those things that are sound relatively easy, saying, hey, we're going to give you a digital payment option, right? Mm-hmm. You can say what it is in a sentence, but the impact it's had on the industry and people's lives are just massive and tremendous. I think those things will continue to come around. And I think financial services and people always talk about fintech and whether it's peaked, declining, still on the ascent, the integration of how money moves and how finance happens and industry happens across industries is getting more and more integrated. There's a lot of people I will talk to who consider Uber's true innovation more fintech oriented than anything else. The fact that you could click on the app, pay on the app, tip on the app, never have to touch your wallet, never have to worry about it, is as innovative as the matchmaking of driver.
Getting a ride, how you pay for that ride,
So I think we'll see that continue.
Because taxis fulfill the same service, but again, the app of Uber is what makes it, as a user myself, makes it a lot easier than going and finding a cab and getting a credit card out and figuring out if you have cash. Do they take cash or, I mean, credit cards?
Yeah, and you saw this, we were talking about COVID, pre-COVID, post-COVID. So many restaurants now have changed that where there's just a QR code on your bill and you click on that, yep. you pay your bill, you can split it across four people at the table. So we talk about sometimes innovation not being revolutionary. We're still paying a bill, but yep. we've made it a lot easier now because I can pay with any options on my phone. I can split it. I don't even have to Venmo folks because I've taken that out of the process because mm-hmm. we're splitting the bill.
Yeah. And the menu's a QR code too in a lot of places.
And you can reorder, which is fantastic. Because yeah. you know,
I was here last week and I liked it, so I'll do it again.
It takes some of the service issues out too. Yeah. Like you need another drink or a dessert, you just order it up and go.
Yep. No, it's true. Well, as you think about entrepreneurial businesses, smaller companies, we've talked about a lot of things. Obviously, the importance of leadership, the importance of a diverse workforce and having a diversity of both opinions and experiences and backgrounds and personalities. Any other things that you would say are really important, critical components if a company really, truly is committed to being more innovative that they need to embrace?
Yeah, I think we've touched on a lot of it. I guess I'll take a macro step back and talk about the U.S. as a whole for just a second.
Sure.
You know, one of the things I think, and politics is such a third word to talk about, and I'm not going to talk about politics, but we have to figure out as a country the immigration question. One of the things that came up, and you look at innovation from immigrants to the United States,
yes.
it's disproportionately higher.
Higher.
And I had someone that a line I stole from someone that anyone who comes from outside the U.S. get an advanced degree, a master's or a PhD, you know, ought to have a green card staple to their diploma, right? They're coming to a U.S. university. I don't care where they're from. We ought to welcome those folks. And if you think about, I think what has driven America for multiple centuries is that we've kind of unfairly sucked the best, brightest, hardworking talent from all over the world to come chase the American dream. And if we lose that as a country, you'll see the impact on us, right? So no matter what your political beliefs are, understanding that great innovators and those non-normal human beings I talk about aren't just born in America. They're born all over the world.
No.
But we want them to help drive our economy and drive the world economy too.
Yeah. Well, and I think the other aspect there, I mean, we are a nation of immigrants. Most of us can trace our lineage back. I know mine from Ireland, but...
But Flanagan, really?
Yeah, I know. That's a shocker to most people. But we have it all traced back and have family in Ireland. But the one thing that probably is the underlying reality of innovation is risk-taking. And I think one of the dynamics that you're seeing play out in our culture as a nation is a pursuit of comfort and almost a self-focused comfort over taking risk. And, you know, I think to your point, when risk starts to be not only not rewarded, but almost penalized, you really are going to drive the innovation equation down quickly.
You see it happen in big family businesses. What's the mantra? The first generation is the one who takes the risk. The second generation is the one who dramatically advances that linear curve.
Yep.
The third kind of maintains it. By the fourth generation, it's on the downward trend, right? It's in decline.
Yeah.
And the same thing can happen in a country and a company. It's the reason why if you look at the Fortune, I forget the stats in that creative destruction book, but of the Fortune 500, a handful have survived 50 years or more, right? Because they're either bought, acquired, they go out of business, you know, Kodak happens and Xerox happens. And so that if you're not replenishing with innovation that field, then you're left with nothing.
Well, it's like Jim Collins, good to great. You know, you write a book and 20 years later, your best case scenarios, if they did not adapt and evolve, are out.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, the whole story of Netflix trying to sell to Blockbuster and being chastised for this technology, this idea is a bad one. It won't work. So we're going to stick with our stores and look at where that turned out. So, I think that's the key thing is the ability and willingness to take risk and sustain that risk. Wisely, of course, but Well, it's been great to be with you today, Dan. It's good to see you again. Thank you for making the time to do this. And again, our hope here is that for our listeners, entrepreneurs, leaders, that they walk away with a few ideas on either A, how they can be a more innovative leader, or B, create a culture in their own organizations of innovation.
Yeah.
We'll put some information again about you and your organizations in our show notes. And I would encourage everybody to check out the work that you're doing, even if you're not in Charlotte. I know you're kind of spread out over the Southeast now. You're doing stuff in Atlanta and all over the Southeast, but the businesses you guys are spawning are ultimately going to, as you said, impact not only this country, but other places in the world. So,
and if you go to the website, you can sign up for the newsletter, keep up with all the stuff we're doing over time, because it'll continue to evolve.
It'll evolve and adapt.
It will.
Because that's what innovation is. So
thanks for the opportunity. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dan. And thank you all for being with us on another episode of Winning Through Culture. Until we are together again, be impactful and stay relevant.